Yeah, there was a hope we might have had a glimpse of London firework, New Year fireworks. Fantastic wall-to-wall display. A bit better than Swanage, probably. And you might wonder why on earth we're looking at fireworks. Well, there we are, because we're looking at that saying of Jesus when he said, "I am the light of the world." And we need a bit of context to that. And the context is that Jesus was in Jerusalem. He was in the temple at one of the three great pilgrim festivals. Every year, as many people who could make it got to Jerusalem for one of these three great festivals. And this one was the Feast of Tabernacles, or Sukkot. And this celebrated or recalled the desert wanderings of the people of Israel en route from Egypt to Palestine. And during that time, of course, temporary accommodation. And they recalled the fact that not only were they in temporary accommodation, but God travelled with them. He had his own tabernacle, his own big tent, as it were, to travel with them. And at this festival, amongst other things, they celebrated every night with real big, mega light shows and invented fireworks then. Oh, come on. I'll take the right way around. Right. Still no better. Oh, yeah. They had in the temple four of these enormous candelabras, menorahs, and they lit them and they had light. And they partied through the night. Jews know how to dance, and they dance. Instantly, that picture, so it says where I got it from, is... Oh, what's happened? That one. Is apparently a menorah made by some optimistic Jews ready for the next rebuilding of the temple. All right, it's a bit of dancing. They had great parties. One of the rabbis said that if you have not seen the rejoicing of Sukkot, you have not seen proper rejoicing. So there was this big emphasis on rejoicing. Now, of course, the week before, it had been the opposite, because it had been the Day of Atonement. And that was when they very solemnly remembered their sins and their shortcomings before God. So now, having had your sins forgiven, you could really rejoice. And my guess is that Jesus parted with the best of them. So that's the context. These great light shows, this great party. And it's in this context that Jesus comes out with this statement, "I am the light of the world." Okay, so what would people have understood when they heard it? Well, first of all, Jews knew that light was about the nature of God, his holiness, that which sets him apart from the rest of us. And along with it went this other word, glory. And the interesting thing is that the roots, so I'm told, my Hebrew is not great, but it comes from that same word of tabernacling, of God dwelling with his people. The glory of God is revealed in his people. And in the desert, of course, there was that big pillar of fire, wasn't there? Which symbolized the presence, the light, the glory of God. There's another story in Ezekiel, vision of Ezekiel, of God's glory leaving the temple because of the sin of the people. Oh, there it is. A couple of other quotes from the Old Testament. We'll come back to this one in just a minute. The Lord is my light, my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Very much personalizing. Not just that God is the light of all his people, but here is an individual meditating upon the light of God in his life. Whom shall I fear? I'll come back to that in just a moment. In terms of the people of God as a whole, these are the people in exile, people in very desperation, looking towards the rebuilding of the temple, the coming back to Israel. The sun shall no more be your light by day, nor the brightness of the moon shine on you, because the Lord will be your everlasting light. Your God will be your glory. Those words coming together again. Here's hope for the exiles, for God to be present again with his people. Okay, he had to leave, as it were, with Ezekiel's vision, leaving the temple. He will again be with his people. And then that goes on. Arise, shine, your light has come. The glory, again, of the Lord rises upon you. There's darkness covering the earth, thick darkness the people. But the Lord rises over you, and his glory appears over you. This is Isaiah chapter 60. And the rabbis applied this verse to the Messiah. Now, when Jesus talks about himself then as the light of the world, people would know what he was talking about. That he was talking about himself as this promised Messiah. But of course he goes one step further, because he says, I am the light of the world. And that's not just a little statement. It is a very definite pronouncement, because in saying I am, he's taking the name of God. The name that was never spoken because it was too holy to pronounce. Remember how at the burning bush, when Moses asked God his name, this is what is the answer he gets. I am. So when Jesus does this, he's claiming to be the Messiah, yes. But more than what people expected of the Messiah, because he's actually claiming to be God himself, not just the representative of God. And that, of course, is a really astounding, blasphemous claim to make. Here's what John says at the beginning of his gospel, saying the same thing as he's meditating upon the significance of Jesus coming to earth. The Word became flesh, made his dwelling, tabernacled among us, and we have seen his glory. So, talking about light, we're talking about God, who God is. We're also talking in the New Testament, and in John in particular, about revelation. You think of a dark room. Everything is in shadows, or perhaps you can't see a thing if there's really no light. Turn the light on, and everything is revealed. Think of a sunrise, darkness, and then all the beauty, especially in the light of sunrise, the color of a sunrise, is all changing. Everything is revealed. Revelation in light. Remember God's first act in creation. Day one in the Old Testament, God said, let there be light. Let there be light. And that's even before the sun was made. So Jesus is revealing God. Now, of course, the Old Testament is full of names of God, characteristics of God. There's just a few of them. There are lots more than that. But Jesus didn't just reel off a list and say, God is like that, I'm like that. What he was actually saying was, if you want to know what God is like, look at me. see what I do. See the kind of person I am. The Word made flesh. Let's look at the stories that surround these words of Jesus. Now, the previous story in the text has probably crept in from somewhere else, actually. But never mind about that. The story as we have it in the text, the previous one, is the story of the woman taken in adultery. And you remember, everybody was out to stone her. Because she's such a guilty woman. Never quite sure what happened to the man, but that's another issue. But Jesus says, I don't condemn you. I don't condemn you. Okay, go away, don't do it again, but I don't condemn you. The next story, after this, or it's sort of part of the same incident really, is where Jesus heals a blind man and then sends him off to wash at Siloam. Incidentally, they used to bring water from Siloam to the temple for this particular festival. Again, people are looking for someone to blame. Whose fault was it this man was born blind? Was it his fault? Was it his parents' fault? Whose fault was it? And Jesus says, well, no one's actually. There's another reason for him to be born blind. And that was so that God could work in his life. But Jesus was not in the business of criticism and condemning. How did the church get that reputation? Because we have got it, haven't we? We have got that reputation of condemning and criticizing other people. We need to work on that one. But at the same time, of course, Jesus was not soft on sin. Okay, he said, I don't condemn you. It wasn't your fault you were born blind. But there's still not to be soft on sin. And then later he would come back to the temple. And he would come back and cause a bit of havoc. Because he was so cross about the way the temple was being used. About the traders who were there making a racket in a place of prayer. Probably about the unsavory practices they were engaging in as well. Swindling and stuff. So he criticized where something was going wrong, deliberately, clearly wrong. He would do something about it. But he would not condemn. So the God who Jesus reveals is one who is loving, sympathetic, forgiving, but nonetheless tough and uncompromising when he needed to be. Okay, well, that's very interesting theology. What about us? What's it got to do with us? Well, of course, I haven't actually quoted the whole verse yet. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but have the light of life. So there is something in this for us. We too can experience God. God can tabernacle, live with us. He can show us how to live and empower us to live that way. And that is absolutely fantastic. But the point is that to do that, to experience that, we have to follow Jesus. We have to follow him. And following Jesus is demanding. It's no easy thing. Remember in Mark, after Peter had made his great confession of Jesus as the Messiah, he says, okay, now, you want to be my disciple, you've got to deny yourself. You've got to take up your cross and follow me. Demanding. It's difficult. And remember that the cross is an instrument of torture. It's an instrument of death. And I think, really, that we are sometimes in danger of forgetting this, that following Jesus can and will be tough. But if we have it too easy here, if we were to live in other parts of the world, life would be a lot more tough. Christians in northern Iraq, for instance, are leaving their homes because of the current situation. And even places where we have close relationships, links, like with Ray in Western China, with Yan in Tatarstan. These are places where being a Christian is tough. Go back to that quote we had from the Psalms earlier on. I've got it on the screen again, I'm afraid. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? That sounds great, doesn't it? But read through the rest of that psalm, and you'll see that the writer is actually having a very, very tough time. He's actually getting quite despairing, if you read on through it. But at the end of the day, amongst that despair, amongst that difficulty, he still says, the Lord is my light, my salvation. Okay, so what do we do then with this light? You follow me, says Jesus, you will have the light of life. What do we do with it? Well, essentially, I think there are two things we can do with it. We can wrap a nice big black blanket around. Now that will very nicely absorb all the light and keep us nice and warm. Isn't that a great idea? But actually, it's not what Jesus told us to do. He actually says we've got to be more like a mirror. There we are, that's what he says. You are light to the world. Let your light shine before the others that they may see your good deeds. We have to reflect back, or reflect on, rather, the light. Be a mirror. Couldn't get any quite the images I wanted, actually, for this, but there you are. There's a mirror, but you get your reflection there. And, of course, the moon. The moon is a reflecting light, isn't it? So if Jesus is revealing God, we've got to do the same as a mirror. And that's much less comfortable than the blanket, but it's a lot more valuable. And we've got to reflect that light in Swanage. Now, believe it or not, there is a lot of darkness in Swanage. A lot of spiritual darkness, moral darkness, social darkness in Swanage. I wonder how we are doing with the light. I sometimes wonder whether we're not a bit like torches. Okay, a torch is a great instrument. It lights up the way in front of you, wherever you shine it. But everything else, of course, is still in darkness. And it's very easy to miss all the stuff that's in the darkness because we can just shine it on where we want to go. I'm just going to raise with you two issues, and they're only two of many. Two issues that came out of the Churches Together community audit we did last year, in which we're still trying to see how we should be shining the light. And the first is the issue of isolation. We like to read those statistics, which are from Age UK. They're not mine, They're not just about Swanage, they're nationwide, but there's no reason why they're not reflected here. Half of all people aged 75 and over live alone. Half. 1 in 10 people aged 65 or over, it's a lot of us, say they're always or often lonely. That's 1 million people in the UK. 1 in 60 in the population, never mind about the aged population. And look at that next one. Around 1 million older people regularly go an entire month without speaking to anyone. Entire month. We've got a lot of elderly people in Swanage, more than our fair share in one sense. So that must be reflected here. And it was reported to the audit by Purbeck Good Neighbours. I don't know if you know about Purbeck Good Neighbours, but they're... But you know, let's see, who knows about Purbeck Good Neighbours? Put your hand up. Ooh, just a few, thank you, thank you. They're an organisation which does one-off jobs for people. Change the light bulb, mend the Hoover, I don't know. Just a one-off practical task for people. And they're saying a lot of the people we go to visit to do these one-off tasks for are actually isolated people. And the other people who particularly mentioned it are the medical practice. Now, I've just checked my facts here with David. Is it true, I read somewhere, that isolation is now being viewed as a medical issue? Yeah, we treat it as such, he says. I think I read somewhere that it's been sort of recognised in that kind of way. So it's not just, oh, it's a pity, isn't it? But there are medical implications of being isolated. And so it was the medical practice who also indicated this issue to us. Now, there is some help going on, obviously. Communicare. Who knows about Communicare? Put your hand up if you know about Communicare. That's a bit better. Thank you. Communicare do a certain amount of regular visiting, but not an awful lot. And they feel they do as much as they can. So in no way are being critical of Communicare. Church pastoral teams obviously do visiting, but that tends to be to church people rather than the community as large. So we're thinking there's still a job to be done. There's still light that needs to be shone out there. We don't know quite how we're going to do it. Perhaps we need a new organisation. The detail's not clear, but please pray with us about this. And however we go, we're going to need some people to help organise it, and we're going to need some people who help do some visiting. And could be you. I don't know what your skills are, your gifts. But please pray about that. Ooh, I would have turned off. Wish I could understand this machine. And the other issue that came up is bereavement. A lot came up. The other one haven't done anything about yet is bereavement. Now, we've all suffered bereavement in one way or another, obviously. And we've coped with it in differing ways. Some of us found it easier than others. Some of us may well have found it really hard and may still be finding it really hard. And of course, particularly true of people who lose their partners or friends when they're very young, or lose them through tragic circumstances. Now, there's no mutual support group for bereaved people in Swanage. Used to be, it stopped. There's virtually no counselling. Don't have counselling, do you really, David, at the surgery anymore? No. I talked to Cruise. Cruise are a bereavement counselling charity nationwide. They've got about 20 volunteers for the whole of Dorset. And they say they can only help extreme circumstances like suicide or murder. However tragic anybody else's bereavement is, they can't help. So again, this is something where we feel we need to be looking. How can we shine the light on these people in our community? Maybe some of you here, for whom bereavement is a big issue. Now, that's just two aspects. There are lots of others, I'm sure, lurking out there in the darkness that we haven't actually seen yet. But our call, obviously, as the church community in this town, the Christians, is to reflect God's light. And it may be that for some of us, we need to be seeing how we as individuals should be reflecting God's light in one of these or other areas. Okay, so let's conclude then. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. I am God. That is incredible. Really incredible that we can know God, that we can meet him in Jesus, that he can bring light, brightness to our life. But we do need to respond. It doesn't just happen. We do need to follow him. If you're not sure what that means, then please have a word with someone. But the implications are really huge, that if we do know him, if he has shone his light in our life, then we must reflect it. And we need to think how. My very last comment is very unscientific, I'm sure. We know what a prism does. It takes white light and it separates it out into its constituent colours. I'm thinking about a prism in reverse. I'm thinking of us, as each of us, as one of those colours, which is an infinite number, of course, actually, of colours across the spectrum there. Each of us there. Now, if we think of it going backwards instead of forwards, if one of those colours was missing, you'd no longer get white light, would you, going backwards? You'd get some other colour light. For God's white light to be going, as it were, each of us have got to be in that prism. We're all a colour. If we don't pull our part, if we don't reflect back, reflect out the light of God, his light will be distorted.